Hello, everyone. My name is Jamie Richards, and I am the Revive Young Adult Minister here at the West Des Moines campus. And normally, I'm here doing announcements, and so I get to see you at the beginning of the service, but Mike and Jeremy asked me if I would speak tonight, and I am just so pleased that I get to be here with you on during the Super Bowl. So you guys are here. Priorities are in the right place, or maybe you don't care about who's playing. I don't know. Whatever it is, you're here, and that's awesome, and I'm so glad to be here with you. So I have two sisters, two younger sisters. We grew up together in this little house in Nevada, Iowa, just up I-35. I was actually here on Friday night, and I never anticipate that anyone is going to know where tiny little Nevada, Iowa, population 6,000-something is going to be. And I was in line for the restroom at the Moxie Matters event that was here and ended up meeting somebody who literally lives two blocks from the house where I grew up. And so that's hope for you, is you just always meet somebody here. And so if it hasn't happened yet, that the world and hope just seems really small, it probably is bound to happen. That's one of the things that I love about hope. So I have two sisters, and the middle one and I, we're all 5 years apart, which is kind of fun when we were growing up to be able to say, when people said, how old are you? I could answer like, oh, we're 5, 10, and 15, or whatever. The ages line up really well, which is really fun. And so the middle one and I got along when we were really, really young. And then from basically ages, like when I was age 12 to 21, 22, we were just at each other's throats constantly. And so it took me going off to college and then her going off to college when we could finally find some common ground. So I don't know about you with siblings. Maybe you're thinking of some funny sibling stories in your head right now. I'm going to tell a couple stories on my sister tonight, if that's okay with you. I called her today, asked her if that would be okay, what stories I could share, what stories I couldn't share, and we had a couple of good laughs about it this morning. So I'm the oldest. Who are the oldest children who are here tonight? Raise your hand. Yes, if you want to get anything done, you ask the people who are raising their hands, right? These are the oldest children. They're responsible, hardworking. Where are the middle children? Any? Yeah, okay, I see you. I respect you. I validate you. Your presence is wonderful. And where are the youngest children? Do we have any youngest children? You party people. I wish I could be more like you. You guys know how to have a great time. That's fantastic, right? And so I'm the oldest child. And I think it's pretty classic as the oldest child. This is something that just annoyed me constantly growing up, is that this next youngest sister was always copying me. And she would always do what I wanted to do, and she would always borrow my clothes without asking, and she would borrow my CDs. And we were talking about this morning, and she said she would even creep into my room and steal my mixed cassette tapes that I made. You know, when you like had to run over to your tape player, hit the record button because the song that you were playing on the radio was playing. Anybody else remember making a mixtape? Yeah, a couple, the glory days. In some ways, right? So she would run into my room, she would steal my mixtapes, and she just liked to copy me. And my mom would always tell me that imitation is the best form of flattery, but I was having none of it. I was just super sick of it. And then to make things even worse, when this glorious thing called puberty happened, we started to just look a lot alike. And so strangers would come up to us in stores and ask if we were twins. And for me, who really needed to just be different than her, she kept copying me and I just wanted her to be different, I would say, no, I am 5 years older, thank you very much. And so you can throw the pictures up on the screen of us if you wouldn't mind, if they are, oh, they're already up there. So she's the one who we're together in this picture, and then in the black and white, she's the one on the other side. The baby of the family is in the middle there. And so people would just come up to us and ask us if we are twins, and I would say, no, thank you. I am 5 years older. Now that we're all a little bit older, I love having people say that she's the one that looks older. That's really fabulous. I just let her take that and have that and run with it, right? And so she was always copying me. This morning, we even figured out on the phone, this is even funnier, and I thought I would share this with you as well. She said, well, you know what? It goes even farther than childhood. I went off to a small liberal arts Christian college in northwestern Iowa. It's called Northwestern in Orange City. I went there, and I have a degree from the religion department. She went to the same school and also has a degree from the religion department. She was an RA, I was an RA, and then I graduated, and I bought an orange car. When it was time for her to graduate and she bought a car, she was looking at a car that was not orange, it was white, but it was the same make and model as my car. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. Well, she didn't buy that car and she bought an orange car instead. So we both have orange cars. And then I moved away. So I grew up here in central Iowa. I moved to Seattle and I lived in Seattle for 6 years. She had to one-up me and she moved to Europe. So she lives in Europe now and I moved back to Iowa 2 years ago and she is moving back to Iowa next week. So we will just see where this continues to go. I don't know about you with siblings. So if you would ask any of us siblings, we would all go to bat for each other. We would all say that we're each other's, among each other's closest friends. But man, stick us in the same room or the same house for 48 hours and we are at each other's throats yet again. And so I think that's how it rolls with siblings, right? Maybe you're chuckling to yourself because you know that that is also true with you and a sibling or whatever your family dynamics might look like. Stick you in a family, in a room with family members for a while and a lot of things start to happen. And so this story that we're talking about tonight involves siblings, and also the TV show that we're taking a look at tonight also involves siblings. You just saw a clip from the TV show called The Crown. Who here watches The Crown? A lot of my friends are watching it. I started watching it with my parents, and they just totally beat me in finishing the whole entire thing. They love it. It's a fabulous show. This show has cost more money than any show ever produced, which as we continue to watch clips, you'll see why. It's beautiful. The costumes, the sets, the scenes, the props, everything is so, so beautiful and so opulent. And so it's a story about siblings and sisters. You got to see this in this clip. There are these two sisters. They love each other very much, but they have some really interesting sibling dynamics. You saw Queen Elizabeth at the very end, and she is a little, she just maybe feels like her sister can throw better parties than her, and I think it's so humanizing to see the queen maybe a little bit jealous of her sister. And so the story that we're looking at tonight also involves some sibling dynamics and some sibling rivalry. But before we go there, let's take a look at where we've been so far in this binge-worthy Bible Genesis series, because I think it's really important to always remember where it is that we've been. So we started with talking about Adam and Eve. And so it's a story of connection and disconnection, right? A story of beginnings, of origins, and we move very quickly to the first murder that happens in Scripture. Brother kills brother, one is envious of the other, and we have the first murder in Scripture. And then we move on to the story of Noah, which is actually a story of, if you're going to look at it in one way, it's a story of genocide, right? Where an entire group of people is wiped out, and Noah is asked to follow God faithfully, even when things don't make sense, even through a full year of spending time with family amidst a ship that probably smelled to high heaven of all manner of things. Talk about fortitude and endurance, right? And then we go to this story of Abraham, where God has promised Abraham that he will have descendants that outnumber the stars. And Abraham and his wife get to be very old with no children, and they take matters into their own hands and decide that they're going to make children happen in a different way. And the end result of that, God still brings goodness out of that, but when they take matters into their own hands, they really start to mess it up, which isn't that so true. And so this next story that we're taking a look at, you might think, wow, those are really messed up stories and those are really messed up people. This next one kind of takes the cake in, as far as my opinion goes, and we'll do that whole story here in a moment. But the thing that I wanted to say right here before we get going with that is that the thing that strikes me is that God is not afraid of having these real stories of real people in the Bible. The writers of Scripture are not afraid of having the full capabilities of humanity on display, right? The writers of Scripture are not afraid of this. God is not embarrassed by this. God is not afraid of what we're going to think. These are stories where God uses anybody, absolutely anybody, which is so good for us to dive into this story tonight. Did you catch that, the favorite word? Gosh, that is a nasty word in families. I never felt like we had favorites in my family growing up, but somebody straight up asked me a couple of years ago, who's the favorite kid in your family? And I had never thought about it, which probably means that my parents did a really good job masking who their favorite child was. And so another story about my middle sister, I just love talking about her tonight. And so another story about my middle sister with in terms of favoritism and favorites, because that's a theme that is present in our story from Scripture tonight that we're going to be taking a look at. My middle sister claims that this is 100% an accident. I think otherwise. I'm gonna tell you my side of how I see things, and she can just be up here rolling her eyes. You can just imagine her, right? So when she graduated high school, there were not enough photos of her around our house. And so she swears this is an accident. I had my little 8x10, and I think it might even be a 5x7 somewhere of like one senior photo with a couple other wallets and like this really cool mat. Just, it's somewhere in the house, I don't know. She went to order an 8x10 for herself and instead somehow wound up with a huge 20x24 poster of her face that she framed and put prominently in my parents' house on the wall somewhere so that she needed to really assert that she is loved. I love how classic that is of middle children and the middle children that I know. So we didn't have favorites in our house, I don't think, at least not that I saw, and maybe I'm blind because I just completely missed it. But favoritism, even perceived favoritism, can really do some serious damage. So that's what starts us off in the story of Jacob tonight. So what I thought I would do, I never really hear the story of Jacob all kind of put together in one fell swoop. So imagine, just sit back, continue to get comfortable. Imagine we've got a campfire up here. We're by a body of water or something. You can imagine that this running water is a lake and you can hear the waves on the shore. We'll just have some story time. Are you ready? So Jacob, before he's even born, his mother, whose name is Rebecca, and his dad's name is Isaac, they have this really beautiful story of falling in love. They see each other, it's love at first sight. They're really super in love with each other. They become pregnant, and Rebecca can feel that these two twins that she has in her womb are wrestling with each other. Man, did she know what was in store for her? I have no idea. I hope that she had some sort of clue. So Rebecca can feel these two twin boys in her womb. She can feel them jostling and wrestling around. And when it's time for them to be born, the first one comes out. He's red. He's got red hair. Babies are red, right? But he's got red hair. And so they see him and they name him Esau, which means red. So Esau comes out and grasping his heel, this is an incredible visual, grasping this little tiny hand on this little tiny baby heel, the second one is holding on to Esau's heel when they're born. And so the second one comes out and they name him Jacob. And they're very, very different. One, Esau grows into a hunter. This is not accurate, but I picture Esau in flannel, in like a button-up flannel, and he's just got boots, and his jeans are a little dirty because he's running around outside. He's got long, wild hair. Maybe he has a man bun or something along those lines. He's got an axe. He's rough tumble, outdoorsy. That's Esau in my head. Jacob, on the other hand, is not rough and tumble, outside, woodsy, outdoorsy. He's not wearing flannel. In my head, Jacob has very nice, shiny shoes and skinny jeans. He is wearing a pressed shirt of some sort. Maybe he has a hat. He's got a hard part. He's very put together, and he loves to spend time at home. He's a really good cook. He's good in the kitchen. He spends a lot of time with his mom. Esau apparently spends a lot of time with his dad, and the next time that we really see them, it has become apparent that although their parents started in love and loving each other very deeply, that their favoritism for their kids, maybe among other things, has come between them. And so Isaac, the dad, is on his deathbed. It's time for him to pass on the family birthright and the blessing to his oldest child. And so something that has happened before this in some unspecified amount of time before dad is on his deathbed is Esau has come home from hunting and he is famished and he is exhausted and he walks up to his brother who has this probably really fantastic bowl of stew cooking and he says, "Jacob, I am so hungry. Please, will you feed me?" And he just kind of like, in my head, he just kind of falls onto this chair or stump, I don't know, whatever it is that they're sitting on. And he just is like, "Jacob, I'm so famished, you have to feed me." And Jacob is a little bit wily. He is always thinking ahead and thinking on his feet, and he says, "You know what? I would love to give you this bowl of soup and to help you, my brother, but I really want for you to make sure that you promise me that I can have your rights as oldest child, that I will get our dad's inheritance that you deserve. I want that when our dad dies." And Esau, I don't know if he's super, super, super hungry, or for whatever reason, he says yes. And so they exchange this birthright and this oldest son blessing for a bowl of soup. We don't really have anything in our culture nowadays that is equivalent to what this birthright and this blessing would mean. It means economic status. It means a different kind of privilege. It means a different kind of wealth. It's double the share that the other siblings are going to receive. So this was a really huge deal, and so Esau gives it away over this bowl of soup. So fast forward, dad is on his deathbed. This is the story that was read for us at the beginning of worship. Rebecca, mom, goes to her favorite son, Jacob. She says, "Jacob, your dad is on his deathbed. He has sent Esau out to kill something, to bring it home, to cook a meal for him so that he can give him the blessing. Now is your time." So they put all of these skins on Jacob. They dress him up so that he will feel like Esau, that he will smell like Esau. Apparently, Isaac is now unable to see very well in his old age. And so Jacob goes in and essentially tricks his dad into thinking that he is Esau. He receives the blessing and the birthright and probably walks out just feeling super good about himself. And meanwhile, Esau comes home hot on the heels of this scene unfolding, hears what has happened, and flies into a murderous rage, which, can you really blame him? So Rebecca runs to Jacob, lets him know that Esau is home, that it's not looking good for him, and that he should pack up and get out of Dodge, which he does. She sends him to her brother's house, far, far away, and so he packs up, and it appears that he never sees his mother again. There's no indication of contact. The Pony Express didn't exactly exist. I don't know if they had carrier pigeons. We have no record, right? So it appears that their relationship is done at that point in time. So Jacob escapes. He runs away, and he goes to his uncle Laban's house, his mom's brother. Upon arriving, he lays eyes upon the most beautiful woman that he has ever seen and falls madly in love. Valentine's Day is right around the corner. You can just feel the love in the air. And so he goes to, it turns out to be his cousin. It's much more socially acceptable to marry your cousin then than it is now. And so he goes to his uncle and he pleads and he says, "Please, I would love to marry Rachel. I will work for you. I will work for you for 7 years. Please give her to me in marriage." And so the uncle agrees. So he works for 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, it is time for the wedding celebration. Jacob is probably out of his mind. He is so excited. Probably parties a little bit too much and has maybe too much wine, because at the end of the day, they go to bed, they go to their tent, they do what married people do, and the morning after, they wake up, and it is not Rachel that he has married, it is her older sister, Leah. So he flies in a rage to his uncle, "Uncle Laban, are you serious? What in the world is happening here?" And Laban is as sly a fellow as Jacob is. It appears to run in mom's side of the family. And he says, "Well, you know what? This is just how we have to do things. This is the order that I need my daughters to be married in. The oldest gets married first, and then the younger ones." And all of a sudden, I have to imagine that the original hearers of this story being told would start to chuckle, because Jacob has just gotten a piece of his own medicine here, right? With this the irony of oldest and not oldest siblings and the order that things happen. And so Jacob says, "Well, okay, I am now married to Leah, but I really still want to marry Rachel. Give her to me. I will work for her for 7 more years in marriage if you let me marry her." Laban now has gotten 14 years of work from his nephew, so he says yes and is feeling fantastic about himself. So Jacob marries Rachel and works for another 7 years. And between Jacob and his now two sister wives, Leah and Rachel, there's now competition and sibling rivalry between these women, these sister wives, and they try to have more sons than the other. Leah is very easily able to have children, and Rachel is not able to have any children at all. So they both each give their maidservants to Jacob and tell her to have children with them, which he does. And so there's more and more competition between these sisters as Leah and her servant are continuing to have children, and Rachel's servant is continuing to have children, and Rachel remains unable to have a child. And so there's this sibling rivalry between Rachel and Leah, and there's this tiny little story buried in this overall narrative that we never talk about. It's this little scene, and you can just imagine some smirks and some twinkle in some eyes. There's this moment between these two sister wives where Jacob, they know, is coming home for the night, and one of them sells mandrakes, this plant, to the other sister in order to have Jacob for the evening. And when Jacob comes home, that sister says, "I have you for this evening." And there's more dialogue that just starts to show that there's maybe actually a lot of trouble in paradise and all of these inner workings of jealousy. And there's no love lost between this man and his now immediate family. So pause on the family part of that. Jacob now has worked for Laban for 14 years, and he goes to Laban. He has these two wives. He has everything that he wanted, and he says, "You know what? I will continue to work for you, but for some payment, I would really like to start accumulating some flocks of my own. So instead of giving me any good ones, I'll just take the bad ones. Give me any of your speckled or spotted animals, the ones that are weak. I'll take those off your hands. You can continue to grow really strong flocks." Laban says, "Sure, yeah, great." And then promptly moves all of his animals a three-day journey away from Jacob, because he knows that Jacob is conniving, that he's deceiving, that he's a trickster, and he doesn't want to have any of this, because he also thinks like Jacob. So he moves his flocks away. Jacob still works the system to be able to get some speckled and some spotted animals and to start to breed them together and to continue to grow his flocks. And he just amasses this very large fortune in the form of animals, of sheep and of goats and of cows and ox and donkeys. And so the whole thing has been building and building and building and comes to a head eventually, and they say, "There's not enough room for the both of us." And they make this treaty, this pact. Actually, Jacob has taken his animals. I forgot one part. Jacob has taken his animals. "There's not enough room here for all of us, Laban." And he sneaks away, which this had to have been very difficult to engineer, all of these family members and all these animals. But they basically pack up and ship out overnight. Jacob says, "I'm done being here with Laban, we're going to move out." And so they go. And Laban wakes up the next morning, realizes that his whole family is gone, so he chases after them and runs them down, and there's this big showdown where Laban says, "Jacob, I cannot believe that you have taken my family, you have taken my daughters, you have taken my grandchildren away from me. What were you thinking?" And Jacob says, "Well, you know what? There's not enough room here for all of us, and so I'm just trying to take one for the team here and move out of, give you your space." And so they make this treaty and they make this pact. Essentially, what it's kind of like when mom has to come into the room and put tape down the center of the bedroom. This is your side, this is your side. They make a pile of rocks and they swear by it, and they say, "This is your land and this is my land," and they go their separate ways. So here's where all of this starts coming to a head for Jacob. Jacob has accumulated a lot of wealth for himself, a very large family, but there's no love lost in this family. There's a lot of tension. He now doesn't have a close relationship with his dad or his mom. Both of them are out of the picture. With his wives, he doesn't have a close relationship with his brother, with his uncle. And so what he decides to do, though, is he decides that it's time to go home and to move everybody back to the land of his parents. So they go back in that direction. And if you were Jacob, what in the world are you thinking about how this is going to go with Esau? We need to buy Esau off, because the last time we saw Esau, he wanted to murder Jacob, rightly so. So Jacob takes this huge number of his goats and his sheep and his donkeys and his cattle and all of these animals, and he tells people, split these in, some of his servants, he says, split these into a couple of different groups, and when we start to get close to Esau, and Esau is coming, go ahead and say, "Esau, "This is a gift to you from your brother Jacob. And look, Jacob is coming right behind us. And then let's have another group, a large group of animals and servants for Esau. And those people will say to Esau, 'Look, Esau, this is a group of animals as a gift to you from Jacob. And look, Jacob is coming right behind.' And then we will also have a third group of animals and servants as a gift to Esau. And they will say, 'Look, Esau is coming, or Jacob is right behind us.'" So he buys Esau off with all of these groups of animals and riches, and he sends them off. Well, then he gets word that Esau is on his way, and he has an army of men with him. Imagine the gut bomb in Jacob's stomach. So he does this. He decides that he needs to protect his assets, and he splits his wives and his family into two groups. And he says, "You guys are going to go this way, you guys are going to go this way," and thinks to himself, "Well, if Esau finds one of these groups of people and murders them all, I at least have the other group of people," because Jacob is just a wonderful man. He's very kind, he's very thoughtful, full of integrity, maybe not so much. So he does that, he sends everybody off, and then he's alone for the night. And Jacob has this moment where things change. Not everything changes. He doesn't become a completely different person, but you can tell based on what happens after this that he has had a bit of a change of heart. He's sleeping out in the wild. He's just got his bare minimum stuff. It's just him. And it's dark. And all of a sudden, this person appears out of nowhere, jumps him, and starts wrestling with him. So what do? If you're out by yourself in the dark and somebody jumps you, you wrestle back. And so they're wrestling and they're wrestling, and they proceed to wrestle all night long until daybreak. At daybreak, they're still wrestling, and this being that Jacob is wrestling with touches Jacob's hip, and either his hip is dislocated or something happens, and Jacob proceeds to walk with a limp for the rest of his life. And this person says to him, "Jacob, you now have a new name. Jacob means deceiver." Jacob has been deceiving people his entire life, manipulating the situation to always be for his benefit. This being says, "Jacob, you are now going to have a new name. Your name is going to be Israel." And that means the one who wrestles with God. And then this being disappears. So what does Jacob do next? He goes out ahead of these groups of his wives and his children, ahead of all of these animals, and he can see Esau coming in the distance. Imagine the anxiety. He sees Esau coming in the distance. I don't know if Esau is on foot, if he's running, if he's on a horse, if he's on a donkey, whatever he is, right? So here comes Esau, and they're getting closer, and they are getting closer, and there are men with Esau, and Jacob is probably out of his mind, frightened. Esau comes right up to him, throws his arms around him, embraces him, and they both just start to weep. So they are weeping and they are weeping, and Esau then eventually they pull themselves together, they're a hot mess, and they pull themselves together, and Esau says, "What are all of these gifts of animals and servants that you set ahead? I don't need any of those." And Jacob is like, "No, you need those. You can keep those. Those are for you." And Esau says, no, I really don't need them. You can have them back." And Jacob is like, "No, really, I want you, just please take them. I want you to have them." And so they have this little exchange, and then Esau offers to escort them all back home. And Jacob is really excited about it, I think. But he says, "You know what, why don't you take these men and you guys go back home? We have a lot of women, we have a lot of children, we're gonna be moving really slow. Why don't you just go?" So Esau packs up. Jacob says, "I'll see you at home, at the homestead, whatever." And so Esau returns home. And then Jacob doesn't go back. He doesn't go to where he promises that he'll go. He takes his family, and they go settle somewhere else. And that is kind of the end of what we see as far as the interactions between Jacob and this brother Esau, this brother that acted really excited to see him. Jacob just goes, and he goes somewhere else. So he's not by his family, and he's just kind of on his own, and so that's where he goes. And that's mostly the end of this part of what we see from Jacob. His family story does continue with his son, one of his sons, Joseph, and we'll talk more about that next week. But I do want to say before we get there is just that everything that has been happening with Jacob, with him tricking people and deceiving people, and all of this manipulation that's been happening in his family does also come back and is present in the lives of his sons, because one of his sons is sold off into slavery, but the other sons cover it up to their dad, to Jacob, and say that he was murdered. And so this continues on in Jacob's family line. And we could see that his birth story had so much foreshadowing for him that he was always grasping for things, grasping for control and grasping for power and grasping for the upper hand in a situation. And so that's Jacob. So that's the whole thing. That's the whole story of Jacob in one fell swoop, which is wild. And so we talked about this at Revive on Thursday night. Revive is the worship service here for young adults. That's what my job here is to do, is to coordinate that and to help make that happen every week, and it's phenomenal. And so we talked about Jacob at Revive on Thursday, and I was coming to work on Thursday after being out of town for a while, and I was eating a cinnamon roll in the car, which just felt like I was playing with fire and danger because it has frosting all over it. And you're wondering why in the world I'm telling you this. I'll get to that in a second. And so I'm eating this cinnamon roll in the car and just feel like I'm winning at life because there's no frosting anywhere. It was phenomenal. Made it to work unscathed, everything in one piece. And so I was thinking about this story in Jacob. Let's put Jacob over here kind of on this mental table like this cinnamon roll. I love eating cinnamon rolls from the outside in. I like peel out the outside and then the next ooey gooey layer, and I save that centerpiece for last. How many of you eat cinnamon rolls like that? Am I the only one? Yeah, okay. Some of you may like eat the top parts first and then save the bottom for later or just throw it away. I have some friends that do that. So that's how I do. I go from the outside in. Let's take a look at the story of Jacob from the outside in. First piece, I don't like Jacob. I don't like him at all. He's somebody that I just like want to dislike. I have no preference for having somebody like him in my life, right? He's opportunistic. He's manipulative. He's always looking out for his own best interests. He's just wanting to cushion his own life, make sure that he's okay. He's got wives. He's got family. He's got animals. He's got the birthright that he's not able to live into because he has to run away because of what all of that means for him. I don't like him. I don't want to have a friend like him or to have anybody like him in my life. Second sweep around. How many of you remember American Idol? It's like what Simon Cowell says, that's gonna be a no from me. I just don't like Jacob. I don't wanna have him around. What is it like to be Jacob though? Let's put ourselves in Jacob's shoes. What makes him tick? What makes him make his decisions the way that he does? Is he a good guy at heart? Does he just have bad intentions for people and for himself? I think that he lives with a fair amount of anxiety and a lot of fear. I think that he feels isolated. I think that he feels lonely. He's estranged from his parents. He's estranged from his brother. He's estranged from the uncle that he has spent so much time working for, like 20 years working for his uncle. There's no love lost between he and his wives and their maidservants that he also has children with. And then he continues to not even have the close enough relationship with his children where they're able to be fully honest with him about what happens. So if we're working our way around this cinnamon roll all the way down into the ooey gooey center, I think that that's what motivates Jacob. I cannot personally resonate with those other parts of Jacob, but I can resonate with feeling isolated and feeling lonely, and I bet I'm not the only person in the room who does. When we make our decisions out of fear and out of anxiety and not out of trust that God has good things for us, that God has good things ahead of us, that God has connection and relationship and promises, and when we take things into our own hands like Jacob, I think we just often mess it up. And so here's the worst and the scariest part of all is that as much as we might not like Jacob, or not want him to be a part of our life, how many of you resonate with the isolation or the loneliness or this part of Jacob that really sums up who he is, this part of his birth story that we see that foreshadows so much about what is to come for him is he comes out grasping. How many of us are grasping for control in a situation or a relationship that seems chaotic? Where we want to have things happen our way, try to make sure that this is how this situation is going to go. Maybe it's at work with a boss or in a relationship with somebody that you really like and you really want them to see the best parts of you. And so what that means, though, is they don't actually see the true you because you've charmed them really, really well. We control and we manipulate to try to make ourselves feel better, safer, and more in control. And so I think that we actually, like it or not, I know this is true for me, I think that we have a little bit of Jacob in all of us. So what do we do with that? What do we do with the Jacob that we see? The little, maybe the little tiny bits of Jacob that we see, or maybe the really big raging parts of Jacob that we see in ourselves. It gets really oddly personal for me because my name is Jamie. Jamie comes from James. And James is the anglicized version of the name Jacob. When I was younger, it seemed like it was the big craze to have these little name plaques with your name on them and their meanings and some Bible verses or some quotes or something. And so I have this little name card that says Jamie and then says supplanter, which means trickster or deceiver. Come on, why would my parents give me this? This is not like an exciting thing that I would want to have on my mirror. I put it on my mirror, and every time I would try to look up the word supplanter, I just kept hoping that there would be a different definition staring back at me. But each and every time, it still said the same thing. And I just kept thinking, am I destined to be a manipulator or a control freak or whatever? And so let's talk about this part of the story where Jacob gets a new name. So Jacob wrestles. He has this moment with this being. It's a little bit loose, might be an angel, might be God himself, because the name that is given to him is one who wrestles with God. I think that's so true because Jacob's new name becomes Israel. Israel is the name for the people of God, which includes all of us. How true is it that we wrestle with God? Man, God, I don't think that this is really how I want things to go. This isn't what I'm not a fan of this. I think this is what you have in front of me, but I don't want it. I don't want to step into this. How many times do we just wrestle with God? Why, God? Why did this happen? This really terrible thing? I don't love this. Why, God? Why? We wrestle with God. There's a quote from another great show, not the Crown, but CSI Miami. Pastor Richard and I were talking about this quote earlier this week, and I think this fits so perfectly. The quote is this: deal with your stuff or it will deal with you. We gotta deal with this stuff in our lives or else it's gonna deal with us. And so what do we do with our propensity to manipulate and to control? I think that in our wrestlings with God, the good thing, the good news to happen here is that God offers us the opportunity to release. But how do we do that? I think that we release by being more honest with ourselves about what we want, more honest with God about what we want, and that involves surrender. I was leaning in to talk to a friend who works in the military at Revive on Thursday, and I said, you're in the military, give me the one-sentence version of what you would define as surrender. And he says, surrender is giving up, taking your hands off, even when you know you could still win. I love that. Surrender is giving up even when you know you could still win and just saying, I surrender and I give this. What would happen if instead of grasping for things that we offered something that you might be grasping onto lately more with an open hand and say, I'm going to give this to you, God, and I'm going to let you have this. Here's the other good news, is that no matter how dysfunctional Jacob's life, how misplaced his intentions, that the name that he gets, Israel, actually means something else as well. It's kind of a name with a double meaning. Jacob has his name become Israel. Israel not only means the one who wrestles with God, but it also means the one with whom God wrestles. God is continually wrestling with God's people, Israel, all of us. God never taps out of the wrestling match. God never gets sick of this wrestling match with us. God never leaves. God continues to wrestle with us. God's presence in our suffering, in our pain, in our lives trying to grasp for control or take over what we think we might want. God continues to be with us. So we're going to check out one more clip from The Crown, and I want you to notice these wise words that gets passed down to the two siblings, Elizabeth and her sister Margaret from their dad. Check it out. These sisters promised this really wonderful thing, to not let anything come between them. And they weren't really able to live up to that, unfortunately. Jacob let a lot of things come between him and his brother. There's stuff that comes between us in our relationships with one another. There's stuff that comes between us in our relationship with God. But no matter what, God is still in this wrestling match with us, and God does not give up on us. Which is why celebrating communion, this meal that Jesus asks us to continually do and to remember him when we celebrate, is so important for us to do continually, because Jesus has done so much for us. Jesus has entered into our pain, into our suffering, into our distance from one another, the things that get between us and other people, the things that get between us and God. And Jesus has said, I'm going to take care of that for you. Yes, it's still going to be present, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. And that God is always with us, always wrestling, and is present with us. And so we have this encounter with Christ in the bread and in the wine, where Jesus says, not only do I enter into this for you, but models what true relationship and good relationship is like, where he says, I'm going to enter into this suffering with you, Jesus, the suffering servant, and I'm going to be here with you. I am never going to give up on you. I'm always going to hold my promises that are true for you, that I love you, that I'm never giving up on you. And so even this night that Jesus was celebrating Passover with his disciples, they were together, and he said, in front of one who was going to betray him, someone who was going to let other things come between their relationship, Judas was grasping for other things, money, power, instead of his relationship with Jesus. And Jesus even knew that, and he said, you know what? On the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took this bread and he broke it and he said, go ahead and take a bit of this food. This is my body broken for you. Every time that you eat this, do this to remember me. And then after dinner, he took the cup and he said, take this and drink this. This is the sign of a covenant that I'm making with you. This covenant where I'm never going to leave. I'm never going to tap out. I love you. Drink this and do this to remember my words. So we're going to celebrate communion. The ushers will guide you to come on up. We practice open communion here at Hope, which means that anybody who desires to have a relationship with Jesus is welcome. Jesus is the host of this meal. So you'll come on up, you'll take the bread, and you can dip it either in the dark-colored wine or the light-colored grape juice, and then eat it, and then you can return to your seat. So why don't we stand? And as we pray these words, our table grace, the Lord's Prayer, I want you to just think about whatever it might be that you're holding on to. And in the parts of this where we pray, let's offer those things to God as well.